So we continue our summer series in the Songs of Ascents, Psalm 124. We're going to do something a little bit different with the reading of this psalm because of the way that it's written. You'll see that the opening line is repeated at the beginning of verse 2. So when it is repeated, the second time we have that opening line, I would like everyone to say that together in response to "Let Israel now say." So this is a song of ascents, and it is a psalm of David. If it had not been the Lord who was on our side, let Israel now say, if it had not been the Lord who was on our side, when people rose up against us, then they would have swallowed us up alive. When their anger was kindled against us, then the flood would have swept us away. The torrent would have gone over us. Then over us would have gone the raging waters. Blessed be the Lord who has not given us as prey to their teeth. We have escaped like a bird from the snare of the fowlers. The snare is broken, and we have escaped. Our help is in the name of the Lord who made heaven and earth. Let's pray. Matt and Rachel, welcome. Welcome to the place where almost nobody cares that England is in the semifinals. But go England! It's like of all the times to be here, everybody over there is probably going crazy. We're like, soccer? All right, well, as we continue in Psalm 124, we're going to do a little bit of looking back at Psalm 123 from last week, because these two are very tightly connected. In many ways, Psalm 124 is the beginning of the answer to the anguish that was in Psalm 123. I think back as I was preparing, I thought back about to the summer of 1997. That seems like a long time ago now. It was. 21 years ago, I was in China teaching English for the summer, and I remember climbing up the stairs to the Great Wall of China. It was a hot, humid day, early July. We had the option of taking the cable car, but I was 23 years old, and I was going to go it the manly way. And I remember counting more than 1,000 steps to get up to the Great Wall of China. And then once you're on the wall, you have to continue walking up to get to the guard tower that's at the top of the mountain. It was a tough climb, and even though I was young, I don't think I was necessarily in great shape at that moment. It was a struggle. I remember stopping several times to catch my breath, and as I did so, it was helpful for me to look up and to look back, you know, to see where I was going and how far I had to go, but also to see how far I had come was kind of an encouragement to know that I could make it. You know, sometimes in life we feel that way. We feel like we're on an uphill trek and we're just tired. And we stop for breath. And sometimes we feel overwhelmed. And that was the feeling in Psalm 123. It was this uphill trek and this feeling of just of having had more than enough. Remember that from Psalm 123, the second half is, "Have mercy upon us, O Lord, have mercy upon us, for we have had more than enough." Our soul has had more than enough of the scorn of those who are at ease, of the contempt of the proud. One of the preachers I listened to, Steve Lawson, when he was preaching through Psalm 123, he talked about the early days of his pastoral ministry where he was struggling just to keep his nostrils out of the water. You know, sometimes life feels that way, and that's kind of how Psalm 123 is, feeling this more than enough. But the psalmist in Psalm 123 does something good, and that is he looks up. "To you I lift my eyes, O you who are enthroned in the heavens. Behold, as the eyes of servants look to the hand of their master, as the eyes of a maidservant to the hand of her mistress, so our eyes look to the Lord our God till he has mercy on us." So having looked up in Psalm 123, Psalm 124 now helps us to take the next step and to look back. And it's interesting that for this psalm, whoever it was who put together the Songs of Ascents as a collection, they went way back to get a vintage psalm, a psalm of David. There's probably more than 500 years distance between Psalm 123 and Psalm 124 in terms of when they were written. We think of all the psalms as being, oh, they were written way back then, and we sort of compress the past. And we forget that even way back then, there were times that were way back before them. So just to put in perspective, we sang A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, right? That was written in the early 1500s by Martin Luther. The distance between Martin Luther and us is basically the same as the distance between David, who wrote Psalm 124, and the authors of Psalm 123. Psalm 123, most scholars believe, was written after the return from exile. The most likely candidate for the background of Psalm 123, and we didn't get into this last week, it's part of what I left on the cutting room floor, and then I'm going to bring it in this week because I think it's helpful to understand. The most likely background for that is actually the rebuilding of the wall under Nehemiah. And if you know that story in Nehemiah, they faced a lot of opposition. And when you read about the scorn of those who are at ease, of the contempt of the proud, this is what was being heaped on the children of Israel as they were rebuilding the wall. So listen to how Nehemiah 4 opens with this. Now when Sanballat had heard that we were building the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged, and he jeered at the Jews. And he said in the presence of his brothers and of the army of Samaria, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore it for themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish up in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burned ones at that?" Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, "Yes, what they are building, if a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall." That's that contempt of the proud that Psalm 123 is struggling with. And so that situation does seem to fit really well, and maybe the scholars are right. Maybe that is when it was written. And if that's the case, then we are going back about 550 years. So we go from about 444 BC, we go all the way back to about the year 1000 BC during the reign of King David. Psalm 124 is a post-victory psalm. It's written by David after winning an unexpected military victory against an overwhelmingly fierce force. The situation that best fits this psalm in David's life would come from the early days of his reign. When David first became king over all of Israel, so there was a civil war period of time when David was anointed king of Judah, but then Israel anointed another one of the sons of Saul, and there was this period of a few years of civil war that was settled, and David was anointed king over all of Israel. Once David was anointed king over all of Israel, the Philistines decided, all right, it's time for us to put a stop to this. If you remember, the Philistines were the ones who had killed the first king of a united Israel, King Saul. And the Philistines had been in an extended period of about 100 years where they were dominating Israel. Going all the way back to the days of Samson, remember him who pulled the temple down on himself. So from the days of Samson through the end of the Judges, the establishment of the monarchy, up to the death of King Saul, who was killed at the hand of the Philistines had been dominating Israel for 100 years. In other words, for longer than the lifetime of anybody who was currently alive, the Philistines had been the dominant force. But now David was the king. And 2 Samuel 5, we read this in verse 17. Now when the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, all the Philistines went up to search for David. But David heard of it, and he went down to the stronghold. Now the Philistines had come and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. And David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand?" And the Lord said to David, "Go up, for I will certainly give the Philistines into your hand." And David came to Baal Perazim, and David defeated them there. And he said, "The Lord has broken through my enemies before me like a breaking flood." Therefore, the name of that place is called Baal Perazim. And the Philistines left their idols there, and David and his men carried them away. And the Philistines came up yet again and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. And when David inquired of the Lord, he said, "You shall not go up. Go around to their rear and come against them opposite the balsam trees. And when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, then rouse yourself, for then the Lord has gone out before you to strike down the army of the Philistines." And David did as the Lord commanded him and struck down the Philistines from Geba to Gezer. Now, if you compare that passage with what we read in Psalm 124, there's actually a couple of interesting parallels, and it's why Psalm 124 was almost certainly written after that battle. And that is, the first of this two-step battle or two-stage battle, the first part of it, David specifically praises God for breaking through against his enemies like a flood. And in Psalm 124, we read, "If it had not been the Lord who was on our side..." Let Israel now say, "If it had not been the Lord who was on our side," then down in verse 4, "then the flood would have swept us away. The torrent would have gone over us." In other words, instead of the Lord breaking through like a flood against our enemies, they would have broken through like a flood against us. And then part 2 of the battle, God says, "Go around behind them." And if you understand that, he means do an encircling maneuver. So you go around behind them, you cut them off from their supply lines, and you do an encirclement. Well, that's what we read would have happened to Israel in Psalm 124. If the Lord had not been on our side when the people rose up against us, then they would have swallowed us alive. That's that encirclement. So the exact things that the Lord enabled the Israelites to do to the Philistines, David is saying, if God hadn't been on our side, that's exactly what they would have done to us. You see, David was a wise leader and a man after God's own heart. And I think immediately after these battles, he wrote this psalm and gave it to Israel to sing because he wanted to make sure they knew it wasn't their new king, David, that they should be singing about. Remember earlier he had gotten himself into some hot water with Saul because earlier the Israelites had sung, "Saul has slain his thousands, but David his tens of thousands." I think David wrote this because he's like, all right, no more songs about me. Let's get to the truth. If the Lord had not been on our side, we would have been swallowed alive. If the Lord had not been on our side, we would have been swept away like a flood. Give credit where credit is due. The Lord is the one who gave us the victory. And he was right. He was right. Without the Lord's help, the Philistines would have indeed overwhelmed Israel. It's not just talk. It had been 100 years of domination. And even though God had given his people some victories during that time, the Philistines were battle-hardened warriors. They were stronger, more fierce, more experienced at warfare. And it's true that without the Lord's intervention, the Philistines would have swept the Israelites away. You know, God does this again and again in his word with his people. Think back to the Exodus, 500 years before David, or 450 years before David. The people of God are coming out of Egypt. God delivers them with these great plagues that strike fear and terror into the heart of the Egyptians. And finally, with the last plague, the death of the firstborn, the Israelites are able to get out of Egypt and they're leaving. But then what happens? God intentionally leads them. On purpose, God does this, not an accident. God intentionally leads them to the edge of the Red Sea, while the Egyptian army has kind of woken up and said, wait a minute, our whole slave labor force has just left. We need to go back and get them. And so the mightiest army in the world is in pursuit with chariots and trained archers and warriors, and a company of slaves is stuck between the impassable Red Sea and the approaching Egyptian army. What would have happened? Again, if the Lord had not been on their side, right? If it had not been the Lord who was on their side, they would have either been swallowed up by the sea or surrounded and conquered by the Egyptians. God did that on purpose. A couple hundred years after that, in the days of Gideon the judge, we have the story of the Midianite army sweeping in, and the Midianites brought 130,000 people strong in their army, and they just ransacked everything. They just took whatever they wanted. They came in and they took all the grain and they took all the treasures and they took off women and children. They just did whatever they wanted to do. They were an overwhelming, marauding horde. And God goes to Gideon, who's, you know, threshing out wheat using a wine press in a cave so he can be in secret because he's hiding in fear, right? And then God calls Gideon, you mighty man of valor, which is one of the funniest lines in the Bible. And he calls him, and then God intentionally whittles his army down from 30,000 down to 300. Why would God do that? He says why he did it. I don't want you taking the credit. Because when 300 guys go into battle against 130,000, you have to say, if it had not been the Lord who was on their side, they would have easily been swallowed alive. They would have easily been swept away like a flood. Instead, 300 are able to surround 130,000 and chase them out of the land because the Lord was on their side. And you could have story after story from the Old Testament, but God does this on purpose. He intentionally puts his people into these situations where when the victory comes, they have to remember that it is the Lord. Of course, God's protection of his people doesn't end with the end of the nation of Israel. We move into New Testament times, when we come into the church age, we know that God has continually protected his people, right? 64 AD, Nero, the emperor. Probably the most likely story of what happened is that Nero himself set fire to part of Rome because he wanted to be able to rebuild it. Nero was a great construction guy. He wanted to be able to rebuild things better. And the poorer section of Rome was kind of the slums, kind of the ghetto. And so Nero probably set fire to it, hoping to rebuild it into something better. Thought he could get away with it. The people started getting angry. The people started figuring out it was probably Nero who did it. So Nero needed a scapegoat. Who's the most likely scapegoat? A population despised by the people and a population that happens to be heavily concentrated in these slums. The Christians. So Nero blames the Christians for the fire, and between 64 and 68 AD carries out the first really violent persecution of Christians in world history. And during that time, Nero publicly executes Peter, Paul, and Andrew, two of the most prominent leaders of the early church and the brother of Peter, Andrew. How could Christianity survive? I mean, it was just a fledgling, marginalized, very small minority. If it had not been the Lord who was on their side, that would have been the end of Christianity. Your most public leaders are put to death. Everyone else is harassed. They flee. It would have been over. But it wasn't over, and Christianity continued to spread and continued to grow until the late 200s and early 300s, two emperors, Diocletian and Galerius, had decided they had enough. This Christianity nonsense, it's starting to take over everything in the empire. And so they actually got to the point where they did what history calls the Great Persecution. This was the most systematic and organized and widespread persecution of Christians in the Roman Empire. They said, that's it. Round up all the Christians wherever you can find them, bring them in, and if they will not sacrifice to the gods of Rome, they will be executed on the spot. And so for the reign of two emperors, over the course of decades, from the late 200s, early 300s, you had this systematic, widespread persecution of the church. And you have to say, if it had not been the Lord who was on their side, they would have been exterminated. But they weren't. And by 313 AD, just years after the Great Persecution, the Emperor Constantine is in power and he declares Christianity legal throughout the Roman Empire and gives it his special protection. Fast forward through history to modern times, and one of my favorite stories from modern times is in China. You probably have heard this one before. But in China, from the 1950s through the 1970s, Mao Zedong was determined to stamp out Christianity. At first, in the 50s, he allowed an official state-supervised church, and he allowed that to operate a little bit, but then, you know, supervising and monitoring the church wasn't effective enough to stamp out the fire of Christianity. And so he declared all religion outlawed. Christianity was outlawed. He put to death around 250,000 church leaders. He took the rest of the leadership of the church, almost any Christian who could read or write, and he sent them off to labor camps throughout the country for re-education through work. I mean, this was a brutal and widespread persecution of the church. But an interesting thing happened. In the early 1950s, when Mao first took power in China, historians estimate that there were maybe 500,000 Christians in the country. Maybe between 500,000 and a million, but certainly no more than a million. By 1979, when Mao ended his persecutions of the Christian church, and they decided to reestablish the government-sponsored or supervised church, the Christian population of China had grown to 10 million. It's a 10 to 20-fold increase in the population of Christianity under a time of systematic, organized persecution. And today, right now, religious freedom observers would say that the persecution of Christians over the last couple of years is the worst that it's been since the days of Mao. It's very intense in places, and yet today, estimates of the number of Christians in China vary from between 80 million to 120 million people. And you have to look at that and you have to say, if it had not been the Lord who was on their side, they wouldn't exist. But God is on their side. What about our lives? Can we look back at our own lives and look at things in our lives and say, if it had not been the Lord who was on our side, where would we be without the Lord? Now, we may not have faced intense, violent persecution. We may not have faced foreign armies, Philistines or Egyptians. We may not have an oppressive government, but still, where would we be without the Lord? If it had not been the Lord who was on my side, I would be lost in my sin. I would be guilty and condemned by the just law of God. I would be alone in the world. I would not know God. I would not be reconciled to God. I would not enjoy fellowship and communion with Him. I would be deceived. I would be believing a lie. I would be not set free by the truth that's found in Jesus alone. If it had not been the Lord who was on our side, all of us together who really believe in Christ can say, if it had not been the Lord who was on our side, the enemies of our souls, the devil, the world, our own flesh would have overwhelmed us. We would have been devoured. We would have been swept away. We would be done. You know, every once in a while, God lets us feel that pressure of the temptation or the doubt or the call of the world, or the restlessness of our flesh. And I think the reason why He lets us feel that pressure is He wants to kind of put us in our own tight spot between the armies of Egypt and the Red Sea. And we say, Lord, I don't know. I don't feel Your presence anymore. I don't know if I believe this anymore. I don't know what You're doing in my life. I don't know why this happened or that happened. God brings us to that place on purpose so that He can bring us out of it. And when He brings us out of it, we have to look back and say, if it had not been the Lord, I wouldn't have gotten out of that. The only answer is God. And so when God brings us out, we can then sing with David and the Israelites, blessed be the Lord who has not given us as prey to their teeth. We have escaped like a bird from the snare of the fowlers. The snare is broken and we have escaped. For Israel, that victory over the Philistines was the beginning of a series of victories that God would lead them to. And at the end of it, they would enjoy almost 80 years of peace and security during the reigns of David and Solomon. They go from being oppressed by the Philistines to being the dominant power in that part of the world. Their empire more than doubles in size, and they control the area all the way from Egypt in the south to the Euphrates River in present-day Iraq in the north. And all of their neighbors who had been oppressing them and harassing them, whether it's the Midianites or the Philistines or the Syrians or the Edomites, they're all brought under subjection to Israel for this glorious time, for generations, for 80 years. But you know what happened? What happens when God brings us into a period of peace and prosperity in our lives? Get fat, dumb, and lazy, right? Oh, yeah, that's good, right? That's exactly what happened to Israel. They became complacent. And after the death of Solomon, Solomon's heart was led away from the Lord because he married foreign women. He was one of the most powerful kings. All these foreign kings wanted alliances with him, and so he married all these foreign women, and his heart was led astray from the Lord. And when he died, his son, Rehoboam, was a real knucklehead. It's the best, nicest thing I can say about him. And he lost the kingdom. He tried to get himself more power and more glory, and the northern 10 tribes said, "We're out of here. We're done." And so the kingdom of Israel split. And those northern 10 tribes, they get a king named Jeroboam, who's chosen by God, but he decides that he's going to set up golden calves for the people to worship so they don't go down to the tabernacle or the temple in Jerusalem. That's a good idea, right? Because that went well the last time they tried that, right? So they end up with two golden calves. But this is what happens. This is what happens to God's people. It happens again and again. God delivers us from our enemies. God protects us. God blesses us. And then we go and we forget God. Constantine gave the church what they had been longing for 300 years when he decided that he would allow Christianity to be legally established and then protected and then blessed. And then before too long, Christianity becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire and then the dominant religion in all of Europe and the Middle East. And what happens? They get complacent, corrupt, immoral. By 1500, things are really bad. 1509, Erasmus visits Rome, and then 1511, Martin Luther visits Rome, and we have accounts of both of these men who visited Rome right around the same time. And what they saw in Rome, the capital city of Christendom, sickened both of them and deeply disturbed them. You can imagine this. See, both Erasmus and Martin Luther actually spoke Latin, which hardly anybody in Europe did, but still the masses were required to be said in Latin. So imagine going to a church and everything that's happening is happening in a language that you don't understand, right? Well, some of the priests and the bishops in Rome, they bought their positions. They got there because their families had money. And they didn't really believe in any of the stuff that they were told to say. But they were educated in Latin, and so they decided to have fun with it. And this is what both Erasmus and Luther were able to pick up on when they were in Rome. Imagine this. They go into church to worship, and the priest is up there in Latin cursing Christ, denying God, blaspheming, and saying vile, crude sexual jokes. And that's the entire worship service. And they go out from the worship service and they see open houses of prostitution whose clientele is all priests and bishops who supposedly have taken vows of celibacy. And then they go and they see Rome building this huge edifice of what's today St. Peter's Basilica. And they were raising that money from the poor of Europe by selling them indulgences. In other words, give us a few coins so we can build our big palace and God will let you out of purgatory. And they go to see this work and they realize it's being done by people who are just entirely corrupt. And they're sickened by it. But you know what God did? God used those two men to expose that. Erasmus goes out and writes a book called The Praise of Folly, which becomes a bestseller. And then he goes on to print the New Testament in Greek, which Luther gets a hold of. And then Luther goes on to write his 95 Theses, which was a protest against the selling of indulgences. And part of the reason why he hated the selling of indulgences is that he had been to Rome and seen what that money was really used for. And what does God do? God uses those guys to wake up Europe and to spark the Reformation and to cleanse his church, because that's what God does. And you know, God does that for us. God does that for us. How many times have we wandered away from the Lord and gotten ourselves into temptation or some trap laid by the enemy of our souls where we're helpless and we need the Lord to get us out? I love this image in verse 7 of Psalm 124. We have escaped like a bird from the snare of the fowlers. The snare is broken and we have escaped. What hope does a bird have when it's caught in the snare of a fowler? A fowler is just someone whose job it is to catch birds, right? What's a bird going to do when he's caught in a snare? Fight? Claw his way out? No, a bird is helpless. That's a picture of absolute helplessness. A bird caught in a trap. And let me tell you something. If you don't know this yet, I'll clue you into something. Satan is a master trap maker. He's been making traps for all of human history, and he's caught more than his share of prey, and he knows what he's doing. And when he gets us in his trap, we are helpless. You might be here this morning, and maybe you're in a trap. Maybe it's doubt that's become so strong that you're not even sure if you're a Christian. You're not sure if you really believe this stuff or not. Maybe it's some sin that you've given yourself over to. And you told yourself you could stop anytime you want, but now you realize I've tried and I can't. If you're in a trap, you can't get yourself out. And in a sense, if you think about that bird in the snare of the fowler, the harder that bird struggles and tries to free itself, the tighter it's trapped, the weaker it is, and the closer to death it brings itself. There's only one hope, and that is that the Lord would break